This is Brian Cambria with the KVNF Regional Newscast for Tuesday, November 26, 2013. The Paonia Eagles are Class 1A state champions in football after a 32-24 win against Centauri on Saturday at Paonia Town Park. KVNF's Tammy Meck was at the game and brings us this report.
Big round of applause for these two schools as they meet together.
The Paonia Eagles football team saw a big transformation this season, going from an average team with an average record in 2012 to hosting the Class 1A championship game on Saturday. The Eagles posted a 10-game winning streak on their way to a 12-1 record, upsetting rivals Hotchkiss and the defending state champion Cedar Ridge Bruins along the way. In the state semifinal game, Paonia trounced the number one ranked Buena Vista Demons, and on Saturday, as if to tie the season up with a bow, Paonia defeated the one team they lost to this season, Centauri, to claim the title. The estimated 1,500 people who came to watch witnessed a true hard-hitting championship game, with the outcome not apparent until the final snap of the ball. The Eagles knew they needed to stop quarterback Casey Jarvis, who threw two touchdown passes against Paonia in their first meeting, and they needed to contain senior running back Jason Burr, wearing the number 3 jersey. Even the Paonia crowd knew Burr was a threat.
Hit number 3 hard!
The first quarter was a back-and-forth battle. Paonia stopped the Falcons on their opening drive, then Eagles sophomore quarterback Taylor Walters threw an interception on the opening play, and Centauri went ahead on a 30-yard pass from Jarvis to Burr. On the ensuing drive, senior Will Austin scored a 1-yard touchdown run to tie the game at 6 points. Jarvis answered with another scoring pass to Burr to lead 12-6 at the end of the first quarter. With 3 minutes remaining in the half, Walters, playing on defense, picked off a pass from Jarvis at midfield and ran back for the score. Place kicker Colby Simpson kicked the go-ahead field goal. With a minute remaining in the half, Walters connected on a 40-yard pass to Josh Altman, and Paonia led 12-20 at the half. Early in the second half, Walters followed his blocks past the defense and ran 60 yards for the score. With just over 3 minutes remaining in the game, Centauri got within one drive of tying the score on a pass from Jarvis to Clay McCarroll. On the kickoff, the Falcons attempted an onside kick. In the scramble, the ball got loose, and senior Jesse Gillenwater recovered at midfield. Gillenwater said he knew a recovery by Centauri would be a game-changer.
I don't know, it was just all reaction. I was going to block, but all of a sudden it was just there, and I wasn't letting anybody get to that.
The Eagles were able to hold Centauri and take the victory formation with 9 seconds remaining on the clock. The final score, 24-32. It's been over 50 years since the Paonia Eagles won their first state football title, and until Saturday, it was their only one. Several members of that 1959 team, including Jack Hayden, Art Edwards, Cliff Davis, Randy Jackson, Bob Sunich, Jess Campbell, and Dan Cholas, came to cheer on their successors. Cholas and Jackson wear their 1960s-era Paonia Letterman sweaters. Cholas went on to coach at Ignacio for 3 years and even had a couple of tryouts with the Broncos in the late 60s. He recalled that winning season and the excitement of claiming a state football title.
What a great feeling. It's something you'll never forget. And in fact, I brought the sweater out of mothballs. It's the first time I wore it in 48 years.
But for Cholas, the best memories aren't of that game. They are of his mom hosting dinner for the team after the win, and the semifinal game against Alamosa that got them to the finals. The Eagles were an 18-point underdog and were down 14-0 at the halftime. In the first 2 minutes of the second half, Alamosa tied the game.
But then we beat them in the sudden-death overtime, the old California playoff, where they put the ball at the 50-yard line. We ran a play, they ran a play, and then they kept track of the yardage, and we beat them on a yardage. So.
State champs, Paonia Eagles.
For KVNF News, I'm Tammy Meck.
We'll be featuring an interview with Paonia head coach Brent McRae and some of the Eagles themselves this evening during Local Motion at 6 p.m. here on KVNF. A handful of waterfowl decoys and hunting blinds were reportedly stolen from the Escalante State Wildlife Area west of Delta on Saturday. Colorado Parks and Wildlife Authority said in a press release the decoys and blinds were set up for a waterfowl hunting seminar scheduled for Saturday afternoon. A white full-size pickup was reportedly seen in the area earlier that day. Thieves stole around 60 duck and goose decoys set up near ponds in the state wildlife area, along with 3 hunting blinds. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration's annual winter outlook was released a few days ago. According to NOAA, winter is likely to offer little relief to the drought-stricken U.S. Southwest, and drought is likely to develop across parts of the Southeast as below-average precipitation is favored in these areas of the country. Though some areas have seen a little relief during the past few months, drought is likely to redevelop during winter. Sea surface temperatures across the equatorial Pacific have been near average since spring of 2012, and forecasters expect that to continue through the winter. This means that neither El Niño or La Niña is expected to influence the climate during the upcoming winter. Mike Halpert, acting director of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, said that without either an El Niño or a La Niña, producing a long-term forecast is a challenge. Halpert said that without this strong seasonal influence, winter weather is often affected by short-term climate patterns such as the Arctic Oscillation. These things are not predictable beyond a week or two. Thus, the precipitation outlook favors below-average precipitation in the southwest, southeast, and the Alaska Panhandle, if you happen to be headed up there. Above-average precipitation in the northern Rockies, particularly over Montana and northern Wyoming, and also in Hawaii. The temperature outlook favors below-average temperatures in the northern plains and the Alaska Panhandle. Above-average temperatures in the southwest, the south-central U.S., parts of the southeast New England, and western Alaska. The rest of the country has an equal chance for above, near, or below normal temperatures and precipitation. Hundreds of thousands of veterans suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, but there's another group of people in the U.S. with an even higher rate of PTSD, and they're a lot younger. That's according to a new report out this month by a presidential commission. Troy Ide is chairman of the Indian Law and Order Commission and also a former U.S. attorney for Colorado.
The rates of PTSD for Native American young people who are exposed to violence exceed the PTSD rates for combat vets returning from Afghanistan and Iraq. There's a whole generation of young people who are experiencing just unimaginable violence.
All that violence is taking place because law enforcement and the larger justice system on Native lands is in the dumps. The commission says the federal government is often to blame. Aspen Public Radio's Elise Thatcher spoke with Ide about the problems.
Indian country is the most violent place in the United States. There's a huge gap between what happens off-reservation and on-reservation. And having spent a lot of the last 2.5 years from the outer reaches of Alaska to the East Coast, visiting many of the 566 federally recognized Indian tribes and nations, the problems are consistently similar or the same wherever you go. We have a failed federal system that results in local government being carried out either by the federal government itself, incredibly, or by states without the tribe's consent. And we have a breakdown in law and order that really is out of step with the rest of the country.
I want to step back for just a moment. How is it that we even got here? I mean, why is it that there's this role of the federal government when it comes to going after lawbreakers on tribal lands?
Well, everyone has a stake in this, not just Native people. The report traces how these systems were developed in the 19th century. The idea of federal control of Indian country was a temporary expedient in the late 19th century. And who would have known that it would have persisted for generation upon generation? The idea that most of the law enforcement would be handled by outsiders. That's an anomaly in our system of justice. You know, we're a country of local control, local transparency. The juvenile justice system is a great example of this. Back in 1938, the Congress automatically transferred custody of Native American juveniles on reservations into federal courts, federal offenses being charged, and then ultimately federal detention. And that system was set up in an era that was very different in terms of the federal government's relationship to tribes, much more hostile. The policy of the U.S. has changed dramatically. You know, every president since Richard Nixon's on record in supporting tribal self-governance, and yet the criminal justice system remains stubbornly frozen in the past. So you still have this automatic transfer of juveniles who are committing local offenses into federal criminal custody. There's no parole in the federal system. There's no drug court. There are no wraparound services that exist in every other kind of jurisdiction. As a result, one of our findings is that Native American juveniles serve roughly twice as long in terms of detention as all other Americans, and that absolutely has to end.
We have two reservations here in Colorado, as you know. Does this apply to them as well?
Yeah, the report looks at all 566 federally recognized Indian tribes and nations, including the two that are headquartered here in Colorado. And in full disclosure, I'm actually the outside attorney for one of those tribes, the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe. And its sister tribe is, of course, the Southern Ute Indian tribe. They're both in the southwest corner of our state. But that is also a microcosm of the issues that we're discussing in our recommendations. The Southern Ute Indian tribe has been able to assert its sovereignty in order to engage in local self-government and has done a superb job by being able to create its own laws and enforce them and hire its own staff and be accountable at a community level. The tribe has dramatically reduced violent crime on that reservation. Now, Ute Mountain Ute, which is right next door, is not in the same situation. It has federal law enforcement. It has a federal magistrate judge. And the community does not have the ability to self-govern when it comes to law enforcement. They don't have a budget that enables them to set priorities. They don't hire the people. Pretty much everything is done either by the Bureau of Indian Affairs operating out of Albuquerque or done out of Denver, about a 400-mile drive away. The rates of violent crime at Ute Mountain have declined thanks to some good steps that the tribe has taken, but they still greatly, by several orders of magnitude, exceed what happens at Southern Ute. It's the difference between a federally imposed system on the one hand that takes away from local control and local priorities versus a local system that's self-governing at Southern Ute, which really has reduced violent crime.
That was Elise Thatcher for Rocky Mountain Community Radio. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria.